mention again this morning. I hope my voice lasts. I am having a bout of a cold again, but it's that time of year. I'd like to continue a study that we have been talking about. We have been talking about covenants, and I wanted to actually, the whole reason for talking about the covenants is I wanted to get to this particular point, and that's to talk about the importance of marriage covenants. We've seen in our lifetime, we talk about sometimes the technology that we see and all the changes that occurred since we were younger. Probably not as dramatic for us as maybe with our grandparents in their days and all the things that changed. But we are seeing a lot of changes in our society. Things have rapidly changed, especially in one aspect, in the view of marriage. For instance, the number of divorces have skyrocketed. I like to do genealogy, and that's one of the things that I've always noted is very strange, is that before 1920, it's very, very, very rare to run across somebody who actually was divorced in a genealogy thing. After that, it became very prevalent, to the point where it's sometimes very hard to try keeping track of who's married to who anymore and whose kids do they belong to whom, because divorce became so prevalent. Marriages today can be terminated just because one person wants to end the marriage. No real reason has to be given, no justification has to be given, other than the fact that they want it. Also, what we see is the number of people moving in together without marriage has also skyrocketed. Sex is no longer being reserved for marriage. Marriage is being called something basically is merely an economic benefit. And that's why they're justifying, for instance, the civil unions for the homosexuals. Because they're saying, well, the reason marriage exists is for the benefits, the tax benefits, and things like that. People have lost sight of the fact that marriage is a covenant that's made before God and is a covenant relationship. But that's because in a lot of ways we don't think about in our society anymore what a covenant is. Going over to Malachi chapter 2, and verse 14. Malachi chapter 2. And in verse 14, yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been a witness between you and your wife from your youth, against you, whom you have dealt treacherously, although she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Sometimes you'll run across people that will ask, what actually forms a marriage? A very common belief that you'll find as well as it's the sexual relationship that forms the marriage. The answer is no. It's never described that way in the scriptures. Marriage is created by a covenant. In fact, you see it hinted in other places as well. It's directly stated here. But in Proverbs chapter 31, Lemuel's mother talks about Lemuel, and in Proverbs chapter 31, and in verse 2, Proverbs 31, and in verse 2 it says, what, O my son, and what, O my son of my womb, and what, O son of my vows? I was kind of curious and looked through a lot of commentaries, and a lot of people miss this. They talk about, oh, well, Lemuel's mother must have done like Hannah did and made a vow to the Lord, and that's why he was born. No, that's not what she's saying. He's a product of her wedding vows. He's a result of the fact that she married. In Proverbs chapter 2, in verse 17, the immoral woman who leaves her husband is said also to have violated her vows. in Proverbs 2 and verse 17. It says, that leaves the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. She made a covenant before God, and she left it, and that's why she's an immoral woman. In an allegory in Ezekiel chapter 16, which we'll use or at least reference a couple of times, God describes his relationship with Israel as a, basically using the idea of a man marrying a woman. And in Ezekiel 16, and in verse 8, he says, then I passed by you and saw you, and behold, you were at the time for love. So I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. I also swore to you and entered into a covenant with you, so that you became mine, declares the Lord God. Using that allegory, God says, I took you in and you became mine by covenant. That's how marriage is formed. And what he's talking about is the fact is that he made a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai and took them in and took them and covered them, protected them. But it works in both cases. Another way you can look at it too, to see this, is the Bible talks about covenant and law as being basically interchangeable terms in the scriptures. You'll find people that deny this particular fact. But just to show this, take a look at Psalm 78 in verse 10. Let's first prove that covenants and law are similar terms, interchangeable terms. Psalm 78 and in verse 10 says, they did not keep the covenant of God and they refused to walk in his law. In Hebrew poetry, you take two lines and you make them parallel to each other. Both of them talk about their refusal. One talks about their covenant, one talks about the law. They're parallel ideas. Another one can be seen in Jeremiah 31 and in verse 33, and these by far are not the only verses you can go to. There are hundreds of verses that basically interchange the idea of covenant and law. But Jeremiah 31 verse 33, but this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. He's not talking about two different things. This is my covenant that I'm going to make with them. I'm going to put my law in their heart. He's talking about the same thing. And if you understand that those terms are interchangeable, then it becomes a little easier to understand Romans chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. Because every once in a while, somebody will stumble over that and say, I just don't get this. Romans chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. It says, for the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law concerning the husband. So then, while her husband is living, she is joined to another man. She shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, so that she is not an adulteress, although she is joined to another man. There is a law. In fact, some of the translations is the law of her husband. What does that mean? It's actually a reference to covenant. She entered into a covenant. She was under law. She's under an obligation, a rule, to be joined to her husband. And so if she goes with another man, she is breaking that law. She's breaking that covenant. And that's called adultery. Our weddings that we have, our traditional weddings, are very steeped and very deeply rooted in the idea of forming a covenant. We lost the sight of it. But a lot of the things that we do during weddings still remember the fact that weddings are a covenant relationship. For example, in covenants, and we talked about all these pieces in the prior lesson, in a covenant you have a section where the parties are identified. Well, if you think about the wedding ceremony, usually at the beginning the preacher asks if the two parties, and they name them by name. Do you, and the name comes up, agree basically to take this man or this woman to be your husband or wife? The parties are identified. Depending on who's doing the wedding ceremony, oftentimes a brief history of the relationship is given that led up to the covenant being formed. We still carry a bit of that in most wedding ceremonies because we have this tradition of, well, who gives his bride away in marriage? As always, the father. But it goes back to there is a history, there is a relationship, there was something in the past that brought up to this point. Sometimes in ceremonies you'll hear about those who being married, how they got together, what led them up to this point, how they love each other. Also in a traditional wedding ceremony, you also have part of the covenant is that you list out the obligations, the things that people are expected to do. And we do that in our wedding ceremonies. You know, I, whoever your name is, take you, whoever's the other name, to be my wife or husband, to have and to hold this day for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish. You know what those are? That's a list of the obligations that are in a covenant. In Proverbs chapter 12, and in verse 4, an excellent wife is a crown of her husband, and she is who shames him is like rottenness to his bones. The reason for entering in a covenant is because it benefits both parties. A man who finds a good woman to be at his side has gained a benefit. She is a crown to him. In Proverbs chapter 18 and in verse 22, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. In Proverbs 19 and verse 14, house and wealth are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. You can get money elsewhere, but it's God who provides a good wife. In fact, in Proverbs chapter 31 and in verse 10, an excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above rubies. The idea is that there's a covenant being made that benefits both parties. This particular case, Proverbs is mostly talking to young men, and so it's talking about the fact that when a young man finds a woman to be at his side, it's a marvelous thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's a gift from God. But also to see that mutual benefit, take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Down at the end of that chapter, 1 Corinthians 7, verses 33 and 34. 1 Corinthians 7, 33 and 34. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and a virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a thing about marriage. Marriage is something that's for mutual benefit. Both should be concerned about pleasing each other. It's about providing for each other. There's a reason why people enter into a covenant to form a marriage. There's also a list in traditional covenants, a list of expected benefits, as well as the consequences for breaking those covenants. And again, we can see that most wedding ceremonies don't go listing through, here's the consequences, here's the bad things that happen. We want to focus on the good things. So usually during the wedding ceremonies, people focus on the blessings of being married. But it's not that it's not talked about elsewhere in the scriptures. For example, when Boaz announced that he was going to marry Ruth, in Ruth chapter 4 and in verse 11, the book of Ruth, chapter 4, and in verse 11, it says, "And all the people who are in the court and the elders say, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrath and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman.'" Here are the crowd blessing them, well-wishing them, that they might be prosperous and that they might have lots of children and that they might be very happy. That's a part of a covenant, is to talk about the blessings that are in there. As far as the negatives, again in the scriptures, in Hebrews chapter 13, in Hebrews 13, it mentions the fact that God's going to make sure that covenant's held in the force. So in Hebrews 13 verse 4, it says, "Marriage is to be held in honor by all, and the marriage bed to be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge." You break this covenant, God's going to step in. That's how important it is. In a covenant, there are also reminders. We saw covenants like, for instance, when God made a covenant with Noah and the world, that he put a rainbow up there as a reminder. Jacob and Laban, when they made a covenant, there was a stone that was raised up to be a reminder that the covenant was in place. What do we do in weddings? Well, we have the rings. The rings are a testimony that there is a covenant. Most people still recognize that. You see a ring on somebody's hand, you know they are married. They have entered into a covenant with somebody else. There's also other reminders as well. Some of the covenants we looked at, they wrote down documents and put them away so that people would remember. The old law, the Ten Commandments, were written down on tablets of stone and stored in the Ark of the Covenant as a reminder. What do? We have marriage license. And you write it out and you file it away in a government building. It is a record of the fact that the covenant exists. We also see a lot of the covenants in the past where, you know, they sat down with meals. We saw Jacob and Laban and their men sitting down at a common meal twice to show that they were in fellowship, even though it looked like they were gritting, it sounds like they were gritting their teeth at each other the whole time they were doing it. When God made a covenant with Israel, the elders sat at a meal at God's feet. Covenant meals are a part of covenants to show that people are now in fellowship. What do? We have a reception. And the two families that are now joined as one by that couple sit down at a meal together to show that they are in fellowship with each other. And there's always the anniversaries, periodic reminders. We always make sure that we try to remember our anniversary, or our wife will remind us, so that we remember that we are in a covenant relationship. A lot of times we celebrate our anniversaries by going for a meal. See, we carry these ideas. A covenant also is, the core of it is the oath, the vow that's being made. And in every wedding vow that I've seen, at least, I hope I don't find one that doesn't, there's somewhere in there that says, I promise. Wedding vows, our marriage vows, are made before God. In fact, take a look at Matthew chapter 19. I forgot to list that one on here. Matthew 19. And starting with verse 5. Excuse me. Matthew 19, verse 5. And he said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. When those vows are made, they're made before God. Just like we saw also in Proverbs 2, verse 17, when we read earlier, about the woman who broke her vow before God. A marriage is a vow, a covenant vow, that's made before God, before a higher power, to say that this is the things that we are going to do. And it makes the two into one. It makes a relationship that didn't exist before, or formalizes a relationship that has been existing. Another aspect of covenants is there's always witnesses. You don't just make a covenant. You have somebody who can testify that the covenant exists. And so in our wedding ceremonies, you have the bridesmaids and the groomsmen. Why are they there? A big part of it is they serve as the witnesses, and the audience too. They're all witnesses to the covenant that's being made. The best man and the maid of honor are oftentimes the ones who sign as witnesses. We still carry that idea. It takes two or three witnesses. And when you sign a marriage license, the groomsman, the bridesmaid, or the maid of honor, the best man, the maid of honor, and usually the preacher, are the three who sign the statement that says a covenant has been made. And a marriage has been formed. Again, going back to Ruth, we've already read that in Ruth chapter 4, verse 11. When Boaz announced he was going to marry Ruth, and there was actually an exchange of rings, in this case, there was a sandal that was exchanged. Because somebody else actually had prior obligations and he gave it up. But the whole crowd says, we are witnesses to this. They were there to testify that the marriage was to take place. You can also see groomsmen in 2 Samuel, or sorry, not 2 Samuel, Song of Solomon. I don't get from Song of Solomon to 2 Samuel, I don't know. But Song of Solomon, I'm blaming on my cold. Song of Solomon, chapter 3 and verse 7. So behold, it is traveling couch of Solomon. 60 men, mighty men of, around it, of the mighty men of Israel, all wielders of the sword, expert in war, each man with a sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. This is where we get our tradition of having groomsmen to lead the groom in. He's protecting them. But they're also there to serve as witnesses. Now, Solomon had a big wedding. He had 60 groomsmen. Most of us can settle for two or three. But that's a part of a wedding as well. And it's part of the idea that there's a covenant being made. One of the aspects of covenants is that they always are permanent. God made a covenant with Noah, and it's still in effect today. We still have a rainbow in the sky. when God made when Jonathan and David made a covenant, it was to last their lifetimes and the lifetimes of their descendants between them. Covenants are to be for a life. Let's go again to Romans chapter 7. We read this before, but in Romans 7 and verse 2, for the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living. But if her husband is dead, dies, she is released from the law concerning her husband. So that if while her husband is living she is joined to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law. So that she is not an adulteress, although she is joined to another man. How long does this covenant last? It lasts for the lifetime of both people. So why, it's a permanent, basically, covenant. It's something that lasts for the lifetime of both parties. In the allegory again that we talked about in Ezekiel 16, where God talks about marrying Israel, in Ezekiel 16 and verse 59, it says, "For this, thus says the Lord God, I also do with you as you have done. You have also who have despised the oath by breaking the covenant. Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I'll establish an everlasting covenant with you." How long was God's covenant to last? It was intended to last permanently. It was an everlasting covenant. They broke it, but God says, "Hey, I'm going to go out of my way to establish a new one, and that one's going to be permanent." Talking about the covenant that we are under now, the covenant of Christ. Going back to Matthew 19, and in verse 6, Matthew 19 and verse 6, "So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate." How long is a covenant of marriage to last? As long as both the husband and the wife are alive. Man is not to separate. It's not meant to be a temporary idea. And we can again see it in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And in verse 10 and 11, 1 Corinthians 7, 10 and 11, it says, "But to the married I give instruction, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife." It's bracketed by two statements that says they're not to leave, they're not to divorce. And even if it does, for occasions other than fornication, even if it does, they're to remain unmarried. Why? Because the covenant's still in effect. Even if they're not living together. It's, like other covenants, meant to last a lifetime. Now, one of the things is, that we pointed out, is covenants make a new relationship. They join people together. The reason why David and Jonathan made a covenant was because they wanted to join their families together as one. The reason why Laban made a covenant with Jacob is he wanted a relationship there. Even though they were family. But there was a division there, and he wanted to make it one. And so in Genesis chapter 2, even though the word covenant is not stated, that is what is implied. We oftentimes have a hard time describing what it means by when the two shall become one flesh. And a lot of people say, "Oh, that's just talking about the sexual relationship." No, it's far greater than that. It's far more than that. Because in verse 24, Genesis 2, verse 24, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The joining and the becoming one is the idea of a covenant being made. What was once two individual people have become one family. The process of which that one comes about is by covenant. That's why Malachi says, she is your wife by covenant in Malachi 2 verse 14. That's what a covenant does. It binds two people into one, or two parties into one. One of the interesting things that I was going through and studying for this lesson, I was digging through some of my old files, and I ran across a little article I clipped out and just stuck in there. It was a letter I had found in the Parade magazine, of all places. And it really captures the idea of what's being said here. It's a little bit small up on the board, but I'll read it. It was titled, You Can Fall in Love for a Lifetime. And their editors wrote, recently we printed a letter from a teenage girl in Freeville, New York, who worried that fidelity in marriage might be an unrealistic goal in today's society. Here's an excerpt from a letter we received in response. And this is the letter that was written. That girl's letter touched me deeply. I'd like to answer her from the experience of 47 years of faithful marriage. It is possible to achieve fidelity, but it requires some things that are not very popular with couples today. Begin with commitment. My husband and I made vows with the intention of their lasting till death do us part. We dropped divorce from our vocabulary. That one made a very strong statement, because that's exactly what Gay and I had done. Before we even got married, we said, we're not even going to talk about that. It's just not an option. You must learn to be content with yourself, within yourself. You're the only one who can make you happy. Don't expect the other person to be responsible for your happiness. I'm not saying fidelity in marriage is a cinch. My husband has a quick temper and says things that hurt. I'm much too sensitive. But we try not to go to bed angry. That girl asked if it's natural to be with the same person all your life, or is it against our animal instincts? We're not just animals. Human beings have intellect. We make choices. You may be attracted to a young man and think you're in love, but look at how he treats other people, his family, his friends, and especially the younger and older ones. Sex is wonderful. It is most wonderful when it's shared exclusively between two people. Love grows stronger when there is trust. Your ideal of two people loving each other for a lifetime may not be easy to achieve, but believe me, it is possible. I think she hit it right on. Marriage is a covenant that you make before God that binds your life with another person. A covenant that lasts the rest of your life. Is it easy to make that into something that works and makes it happy? No, it's something that you work at. Is it possible? Yes. There are lifetimes of people who've done so. You see, because a marriage covenant is mutually beneficial, both the husband and the wife ought to work at making the marriage work. Our scripture reading in Ephesians chapter 5, I meant for it to go all the way down to the end of the chapter, but in Ephesians chapter 5, let's take a look at it again. Ephesians chapter 5. Since we didn't get to read the whole thing, I'm going to start again in verse 22. Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, and having cleansed her by the washing of water by the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to also love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking in reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife as himself, and the wife is to see to it that she respects her husband. What is the core of this statement? There is a covenant that's been made that's mutually beneficial to both parties. The two have become one. Now, why would you make a covenant with somebody and then turn around and hate that person? Why would you join yourself with someone else and not give them respect? It's to be mutually beneficial. And so you work at helping things out. There are going to be times when one or the other can't hold up his end and the other then takes over to cover for them. That's exactly how God treated Israel in the past. Israel definitely did not keep up his end of his covenant. Did that mean then that God just dropped everything right then and there? No, in Hosea chapter 2 and in verse 19, it says, I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in loving kindness and in compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know that I am Lord. That is the idea of mercy or loving kindness in this particular translation. Is the concept is in a covenant that what makes a covenant work is the fact that the other person shows mercy. They cover for the other person when they can't hold up their end of the bargain. That's what God did for Israel. He showed them mercy. In Jeremiah chapter 3, Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 14. God says, return, O faithless sons, declares the Lord. For I am master to you, and I will take you from one city and two from a family, and I'll bring you to Zion. Then I will give you shepherds after my own heart, who will feed you on knowledge and understanding. God was willing to go out of his way to help Israel come back to him, despite the fact that they were faithless. And that was the idea of mercy. Today we lose that idea. One party gets mad at the other for whatever reason, and they declare, okay, this marriage is over with. You're in a covenant relationship. You work at making it work. Because that's the idea of mercy. See, marriage is a covenant relationship between a man and a woman that takes two lives and forms it into one. You can't accidentally go into a marriage. That's what started this whole thing. My trying to convince a young man that you can't just say, hey, you know, talk to a young woman and say, hey, I promise to be with you the rest of my life, and suddenly you're married. That's not a covenant. It's much more formal. It's much more serious. It has a lot of aspects to it. Two people living together don't make a marriage. That very idea that's back in the old days when they had common law marriages. That's not a marriage. Marriages are and always will remain special relationships formed by a covenant that binds two people into one. And I hope that was useful to you and interesting. I got some more things to talk about the state of marriage this evening. I done it a lesson like that a while back, but I decided that it needed to be updated. It's been about 12 years since I've done it, and I wanted to go back through it and show you what's happening in our society as far as marriage is concerned. But until that time, we'd like to offer an opportunity as we're gathered together. If anyone here is not yet a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ, to enter in a covenant with Him that's sealed and formed by baptism. Because that's what Colossians tells us, that baptism is like the circumcision of the old covenant. It is our witness and seal that we have entered into a covenant with Christ. If anyone here wishes to become a child of God, there's no better time than right now. If there's anyone here is a child of God, would like the prayers of brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song selected.